Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Make it clear to Putin and to China that Europe and the United States are tight.
As President Biden hits the road for Europe, Belarus opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya throws down the gauntlet. The U.S. needs to get tougher on authoritarian ruler Alexander Lukashenko. Then,
let's all be stronger from a cybersecurity perspective so that actually those who wish to do us harm cannot succeed in doing so.
A surge of ransomware attacks threatens to choke the global economy. Why we're vulnerable and how to fight back. I speak to security expert Chris Krebs and ransomware negotiator Curtis Minder. And surgeon, scientist, inventor, philanthropist, and owner of the LA Times, Walter Isaacson, talks to Dr. Patrick Soon-Chiong.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Ladriga in New York, sitting in for Christiane Amanpour. Christiane is on medical leave and will be back very soon. Now, as President Biden lands in Europe for a week of summits, he sets himself a high bar. In his meetings with G7 and NATO leaders and his face-to-face with Vladimir Putin, the U.S. president is out to prove the viability of democratic institutions and alliances. But as leaders prepare to grapple with the economic and health shocks of the COVID pandemic, the climate crisis, and with crippling ransomware attacks, an opposition leader from a beleaguered country of Belarus fires a shot across their bow. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya appears before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today with an urgent call for a tough global response against President Lukashenko's brutal regime. Tikhanovskaya was forced to flee to Lithuania after she opposed Lukashenko in the fraudulent 2020 presidential election there. The former English teacher has quickly emerged as the leader of the Democratic opposition, and she joins me now from Prague. Svetlana, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
You spoke before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today, where you sounded the alarm and compared Belarus under Lukashenko to North Korea in Europe. Explain why and what was their reaction?
You know, Lukashenko now doing everything to isolate Belarusian people from the world. He's trying to silence people, to threaten people, to make people scared. Thousands of people are in jail. Thousands of people who had courage to said they was against regime. And now he is torturing people. He is violating people just to make them silence.
You mentioned people in jail. There are currently more than 470 political prisoners alone in prison just over the past few years under Lukashenko after he ordered that Ryanair plane to land in Minsk to arrest and detain that opposition journalist Roman Protasevich. We saw a number of sanctions from neighboring EU countries, the United States as well, basically isolating the country. This is something that you were in favor of as well. And the U.S. ambassador to Belarus, Julie Fisher, who incidentally is not allowed into the country by Lukashenko, she has warned that there will be more sanctions coming. Is the response appropriate, in your opinion, or should there be a greater response?
You know, I think that democratic countries' most powerful leverage is sanctions. And sanctions scare regime of Lukashenko because this economic isolation will not let him to pay the right policemen, and sanctions will stop violence, will help to release political prisoners. And we have already had three packages of sanction list from European Union and sanctions from the USA. And after this accident with flight, we hope that response of European Union will be much, much stronger, because now Lukashenko is threatened not only to Belarusian people, not only inside the country, but he's threatened to international community.
And with his back against the wall now, as he is isolated, that puts him into the orbit of Vladimir Putin, who really is his benefactor. The two met last week in Sochi. And we know that Vladimir Putin has extended more credit, more money to the beleaguered country. He was just asked last week, Vladimir Putin was asked, what would he do? Would he bring a plane down in a similar fashion if a dissident was on board? And he sort of joked and laughed, I'm not going to tell you. With all of that in mind, we know that there's going to be an upcoming summit next week between Vladimir Putin and President Biden. What would you advise President Biden to say to Vladimir Putin in regards to Lukashenko and Belarus?
You know, I think that Mr. Biden has to pass four clear messages to the Kremlin that situation in Belarus is not about geopolitics. It's our fight against regime inside the country. The second message is that to get out of this political and humanitarian crisis, we have to hold new free and fair elections this year. And the third message is that Russia has to stop support regime Lukashenko. Because supporting regime, Kremlin is supporting violence and tortures in Belarus. And the fourth one and the last, that independence and sovereignty of Belarus is not for trade.
Do you worry that continued sanctions and pressure against Lukashenko will only help Putin in the sense that he has long wanted to bring Belarus back into the Russian orbit? Your hopes and your dreams for your country are to be a free democracy. Are you worried that the sanctions may be counterproductive and could help Putin more than hurt Lukashenko?
You know, we have to emphasize that sanctions are against the regime to stop violence and release political prisoners. And integration of Belarus into Russia is already too tight. And the last step is losing sovereignty. And we send clear message that people will defend our sovereignty. So we have to urge Kremlin that people will defend the sovereignty and that Kremlin doesn't have to use weakness of Lukashenko just to reach any aims.
And as we mentioned, this heightened tension and the pressure on Lukashenko stemmed from the detainment of Roman Protasevich. We saw that horrible video of him last week in that mockery of an interview where you could tell that he was forced to speak the praises of Lukashenko. There were marks on his arms, and you see him crying there, clearly in a lot of stress and under a lot of stress. His father has reported that he is severely ill with tonsillitis. How concerned are you about his welfare, and what do we know?
You know, Roman's lawyer didn't get access to Roman for 10 days. And today we know that already his lawyer had opportunity to visit him. And he's badly damaged. He's in awful moral situation. And we are sure that he was tortured. Lawyer can't say everything about his state. But we all know in how such videos are shot, under what pressure people are there in jails, and that they are tortured to say what regime wants to hear.
Svetlana, you know this firsthand. You're not only fighting for the freedom of your country, you're fighting for the freedom of your husband as well. You were not in this position just a couple of years ago to be an opposition leader. It was your husband who initially had taken on Lukashenko in that mockery of an election. Your husband has been in jail now for a year, and you testified today that your five-year-old daughter equates jail with a business trip. And that she always asks, you know, when is he going to be home from that trip? What has this been like for you, and how is your husband doing?
You know, my husband, as you said, the whole year in jail, innocent person. And, of course, his moral state is awful. It's, you see, he's losing his years of life he's losing his health there. And of course, we have to do everything possible to release him and other political prisoners as soon as possible. You know, as for me, if political prisoners are make me keep going, because I feel all this pain as the wife of political prisoner, as the friend of political prisoners, as the relative of political prisoners. And I understand that they sacrificed with their lives, years of their lives, to give us opportunity to continue this fight against regime. So this keep me going, and I will do everything possible to release all of them and bring our country to new elections, just because of sufferings of those people.
And those sufferings have been seen around the world, as have the valiant and brave protests, in particular, of so many women, Belarusian women, fighting for independence and democracy. And obviously, you have been leading the way there. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, thank you so much for joining us today. And of course, we will continue covering your battle as well.
Thank you. Stand with us.
Thank you. Well, cybersecurity is another critical priority for Joe Biden's meetings with world leaders this week. Ransomware attacks surged in 2020 with more than 300 million cases reported. So when President Biden meets Vladimir Putin in Geneva, he'll challenge Putin to crack down on cyber criminals operating with impunity inside Russia. Already this year, ransomware threats jammed energy and food distribution in the United States. Correspondent Alexander Marquardt has the latest in this report.
1 month after the cyber attack by Russian hackers that crippled Colonial Pipeline and caused long lines at gas stations up and down the East Coast, the company's CEO defended his decision to pay the attackers $4.4 million.
It was the hardest decision I've made in my 39 years in the energy industry, and I know how critical our pipeline is to the country, and I put the interests of the country first.
CEO Joseph Blount, who said his company carries almost half the fuel on the East Coast, said he was deeply sorry for the impact of the breach, but argued his focus was getting operations back up and running.
I believe with all my heart it was the right choice to make, but I want to respect those who see this issue differently.
Blount admitted that despite spending $200 million in the past 5 years on cybersecurity, they did not have a plan for the growing wave of ransomware attacks. In the immediate aftermath of the attack on Colonial's IT system, Blount said they contacted the authorities.
We reached out to the FBI within hours.
It was that cooperation, both he and the Justice Department now say, helped the FBI track down and recover most of the ransom paid, the cryptocurrency Bitcoin, to the Russian hacking group DarkSide.
Ransomware attacks are always unacceptable. But when they target critical infrastructure, we will spare no effort in our response.
The six-day shutdown of the pipeline was a startling reminder of how vulnerable the country is. It was immediately followed by another attack, also by Russian cyber criminals, on the world's biggest meat producer, JBS Foods, which took all of their American beef plants offline.
Cyber attacks used to be merely an inconvenience. We now know that they're becoming attacks on our very way of life.
News broke that a service for constituents in almost 60 congressional offices had been targeted in a ransomware attack. So far, there's no evidence any sensitive information was obtained, but it underscored our new reality.
No one is safe from these attacks, including us.
It is that recognition that society across the board is vulnerable to these growing attacks that has made this such a focus for the White House. It is rare to hear cyber issues mentioned so frequently as a presidential-level priority heading into a series of major international meetings, but that will be the case over the coming week as President Biden travels to Europe, both in his meetings with G7 and NATO partners, and of course in that critical summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin, where Biden is expected to tell Putin that Russia has to crack down on these cyber criminals operating from Russia against the United States.
Alex Marquardt reporting there. Well, let's dive deeper into this now with Chris Krebs, co-founder of the Krebs Stamos Group and former director of the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. He is joining me now from Washington. Chris, great to have you on the show. And I think it's telling as to how prevalent these cyber attacks are that we continue to see on our airwaves. You know, we're covering this obviously behind the scenes, but for millions of Americans, this isn't something that was front and center, and now it is.
Last year alone, 2,400 U.S.-based governments, healthcare facilities, schools were victims of ransomware attacks. Obviously, we now know the Colonial Pipeline, the JBS meat supplier, some of the more high profile. Why are they becoming so much more prevalent?
Bianca, thanks for having me on. Well, I think what we're seeing here more than anything is an accretive problem, in that ransomware attacks have been going on for a number of years, a decade or more. But with the prevalence of cryptocurrencies that enable payment, a safe haven within states like Russia allowing it to happen, and frankly, a very vulnerable critical infrastructure base here in the United States, those three things have come together and seen this explosion, at least of what we've seen over the last several months. But again, it's been happening for quite some time. And unfortunately, there's not yet been enough done, including putting consequences on the ransomware actors, to really change the calculus of any of these attacks.
Well, it's risen to the level of an executive order issued by President Biden just a few weeks ago, and this order requires federal agencies to implement additional IT security measures and set standards for commercial software. You call this an ambitious order. This is for the federal government agencies, of course, but do you anticipate that this will trickle down to the private sector as well?
I do. I think that executive order, released about a month or so ago, was actually prompted by some of the espionage-based attacks that happened earlier in the year and even at the tail end of the Trump administration. But there will be cascading effects because the products, the software products and services that the federal government buys are the exact same products and services that our critical infrastructure owners and operators buy and deploy. So those requirements that will be leveraged by the purchasing power of the federal government will have a cascading effect over the private sector.
And we saw why this is a national security threat, given what happened with the Colonial Pipeline shutdown and that cybersecurity hack there. When you look, however, at what even the CEO has been testifying before lawmakers, he said today, "We have rebuilt and restored our critical IT systems and are continuing to enhance our safeguards, but we are not yet where I want us to be." Does that alarm you?
It is perhaps alarming, but at the same time, not necessarily unexpected. I would probably take it up a few levels above the colonial issue and just think more broadly about our critical infrastructure businesses in this country. Every single chief executive, every single leadership team needs to be watching these hearings and saying, how am I going to improve my organization's cybersecurity posture? Every single senior leadership team in every business in America should be asking questions amongst their security team, their legal team, their boards of directors. What are we going to do if we get hit with a ransomware attack? How are we going to respond? Can we recover? Who are we going to call and how quickly? And are we going to pay the ransom? There are things you can do right now to prepare for an event and prevent it. But most importantly, if you do have that bad day, that you can respond and recover perhaps a little bit better than you would previously.
And it's not only CEOs and investors who are paying attention now. Everyday consumers are too, right? When you can't go get your beef at the grocery store, when you're waiting for hours to put gasoline in your car, you see that trickle-down effect in real life. A lot of these attacks originate, and these hackers are in Russia. They originate from Russia or former Soviet republics there. We know that President Biden will be meeting with Vladimir Putin next week, and this is a very top priority for them to discuss. Whether or not Putin has signed off on these hacks, there's a clear sense that he's not doing enough to clamp down on them, one of the indications being that it's not necessarily Russian companies that are the recipients of these attacks. In fact, I know that there is study and investigation showing that when these hackers see Cyrillic keyboard use, they tend to leave these companies alone. So aside from knock it off, what is it that President Biden should say to Vladimir Putin to at least deter him or to put more pressure on him to handle this differently?
Well, I think to start with, this is not a uniquely American problem. The Irish National Health System, there have been French companies, German companies, European countries all over the place that have been hit with ransomware attacks. And so we have allies through the G7 and the G20. And so when you look at the president's European swing here, he will be bringing up, as I understand it, ransomware at every stop. And so when the president does meet in Geneva with President Putin, he will have a group of other countries and multilateral groups flanking him, saying, we've had enough. It's time to clean up the Russian internet ecosystem and not allow this stuff to happen anymore. And there are things that individually we can do as countries, including perhaps enhanced regulation over cryptocurrencies, it's more stringent requirements over hosting and other internet-based services. Those are the sorts of things that can make it harder for the criminals to act. But fundamentally, we cannot accept as a global community safe harbor for these criminal groups that are, frankly, it's only going to get worse in the coming months and years.
And typically, the sort of policy from the U.S. government is not to pay these ransoms, to avoid paying them, because they set a precedent. And obviously, we've seen the price tag on these ransoms go up over the years. However, there are some critical infrastructures, like hospitals, where you do need to pay. You don't really have much of an option, and you're deciding whether or not to pay this exorbitant fee or to keep people alive. So how do you break that down as far as your approach to this? I know that you fundamentally believe that this should not be taking place, but in these life or death circumstances, what should companies do?
Well, you already hit it in that I am fundamentally a don't pay. I fall in that camp, but I understand that there are edge cases that may require, certainly in life or death situations or existential risks for the companies themselves, that they need to pay. I think at a minimum, we have to have mandatory reporting, not just on ransomware incidents, but larger scale cybersecurity incidents, like what we saw last year with the Russian SVR hack on a Texas software company, SolarWinds. We have to provide more information to law enforcement and my old agency, CISA, to ensure that we understand what's happening out there. Because without, with imperfect information, you make imperfect decisions. And we have to have a better understanding of what the real denominator, particularly for ransomware attacks, are. And so it's mandatory reporting at a bare minimum.
We know, Chris, that the U.S. government has the largest arsenal, probably, of cyber hacking tools. And that's through the NSA or the CIA. And in terms of helping companies within the United States avoid these cyber attacks, should more tools be shared? Obviously, not to the extent that you give up any of your tactics with our targets or opponents around the world. But would that be more helpful if the U.S. government actually shared some of these valuable tools with U.S. companies?
I certainly think we need to continue sharing practical cybersecurity advice with our businesses here in the United States. And the unfortunate reality is good basic cybersecurity practices are still hard to do. So we need our IT sector partners and our cybersecurity vendors to make it easier to defend networks. So that's point one. Point two is we do have capabilities within the intelligence community and the defense community that can be brought to bear to impose some costs, to put some consequences on these actors. And I think what we're really seeing come home to roost more than anything is we have been focused on state actors, state intelligence services, and over time, given room to run, these criminal gangs, these cyber criminals, have unfortunately been a little too successful, if not a lot too successful, and it's time to draw our attention on them and make them feel a little bit of pain.
Well, Chris Krebs, this is a very complicated subject matter. I think for a lot of people at home, they find it intimidating and over their heads. But the last few weeks and the last few months, obviously, is a reminder that this is something everybody should focus on. And I just want to end by saying we've been talking about a lot of the hits that the U.S. has taken. Obviously, with your leadership in terms of the election in particular, that was an overwhelming success. So thank you so much for keeping us safe in that aspect. And thank you for joining us and breaking it down for us. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Bianna.
Well, listening to that is someone with a slightly different perspective. Curtis Minder is the CEO of GroupSense, a cybersecurity firm. He's also a ransomware negotiator. Welcome to the program, Curtis. And that is sort of a new term for us, a ransomware negotiator. But here we are. First of all, walk us through what it is your job entails.
Well, ransomware negotiation is a small part of what our business does. We sort of fell into it about 2 years ago, sort of accidentally. And over the last 2 years, we've spearheaded negotiations for large enterprises, small businesses, and everything in between, basically facilitating the communication between the victim and the ransomware operators.
So when you heard that conversation that I just had with Chris Krebs, where he said in most circumstances, obviously you have to take one at each as their own, especially when there is life and death at stake. But for the most part, he, along with the U.S. government, advise against paying these ransoms. What is your response to that?
I actually work closely with law enforcement. Every time we do one of these incidents, we work with the local FBI field office. We encourage our clients to notify law enforcement each time. And yes, they do advise not to pay the ransom. However, many of these companies are small businesses or medium businesses that there is no other option. It's either pay the ransom or go out of business. And of course, in the case of healthcare or critical infrastructure, people could be at harm. So until there's a better option, I think it is necessary to leave this on the table as a possible tool to resolution.
If you don't mind me asking, how does one train to become a ransomware negotiator? I know that this is something you've picked up over the years through experience, but is this going to be sort of a new model, a new profession? Where did you get your background?
Well, I certainly hope this doesn't become a pervasive profession. I hope, to some of Chris's points, I hope with some government intervention and some better cybersecurity hygiene, this is a part-time thing and it goes away. But as far as how do you train, the negotiation principles for negotiating with hostages, negotiating to buy a car, or negotiating with threat actors are very similar. The difficulty in training, what we do is, in most of the other cases, you can read tone, intonation, things like that. In this case, we're often negotiating over a dark web chat site. So it's almost like negotiating over text message, which makes it very difficult to read those things. And those things are important. So there is a skill to learning the language. And many of these threat actors that we're dealing with are English as a second language, obviously. So reading through their poorly translated words to find sort of nuances and tone.
Yeah, I know your girlfriend has actually been helpful for you in that sense because she speaks Russian and Romanian and some other Eastern European languages, and she's taught you, or you refer to a lot of these hackers as grasshoppers or kuznetchiks, right? Yeah. Why do you try to develop a relationship with what most people would just assume are bad guys?
Well, you don't want to go into it calling these folks bad guys. They know what they're doing is wrong. Everybody's going to justify their actions in some way. So, just driving toward the desired outcome, which is to reduce the ransom to the most the smallest amount possible. The best approach is to treat these folks like business associates and the whole process like a business transaction.
But I mean, I guess it's hard to. I mean, I understand where you're coming from and your perspective. But I think for those at home or those who have had to wait in line for days to get gasoline or worried about beef or whether they're going to be hacked, they don't view this as a business transaction. They view this as a black and white bad guy, good guy. And what do you say to those who may think that you're encouraging this type of bad behavior?
Well, we certainly don't want to pay the threat actors any more than the victims do. But like I said, in this case, if there were a better option, and I think Chris alluded to this, that if the U.S. government could put together a comprehensive program that not only helps companies prevent this on the front end with the basic cyber hygiene, but also helps with the recovery without paying the ransom, then we could avoid this altogether. In most cases, though, that this is one of the only tools available to these companies to solve the problem. And regardless of whether you negotiate or not, those companies are actually impacted by this. So there's going to be lines at the gas stations regardless, and potentially it could be longer to recover.
And what makes this more difficult and more challenging, as what Chris alluded to as well, is the role of cryptocurrency, right? And blockchain, it's much harder to trace for this specific reason. And I want to get your reaction to what the U.S. government did in trying to claw back some of that money that was paid from Colonial Pipeline just this past week, about $2.3 million in bitcoins. Does that change the game? Was this sort of a one-off, Or did you see something there that could actually help penetrate and maybe minimize some of these attacks in the future?
Our day job is actually cyber reconnaissance. So we spend a lot of time tracking, tracing bad guys, and we do a lot of cryptocurrency tracing and tracking, both with the transactions and in our regular day jobs. So what I would say is, yes, it's impactful. However, the threat actors have a lot of options, and they will simply move to other platforms that are less likely to be able to be traced. So we've even seen this in the transactions we've done in the last year, where a lot of the threat actors are moving away from the Bitcoin platform and to other platforms like Monero, which are very difficult to trace.
When the government would tell a CEO of a company that's been hacked, right, and has ransomware demanded of them and pay, would you suggest, like the government does, that they notify authorities first or reach out to you? Because you said you work with authorities, but how is it you work both ways? Or, I mean, explain that to us.
So when we get called in on an incident, the first thing we do is we have a business discussion with the client about the impact to the business. That's going to help us determine whether we pay the ransom or not. The next thing I do is encourage them to involve law enforcement. And some of them choose to do that, some of them do not. In any case, whenever we are asked to cooperate with FBI, whether that's giving them indicators or threat intelligence data that we collect, we absolutely comply with that, and we're very friendly with those organizations.
We're spending a lot of time focusing on Russia right now, and rightly so. That's where a lot of these hacks originate. What is there that you see, perhaps, that we don't? What worries you? What keeps you up at night in terms of the next level of these attacks?
Chris said one of my favorite things, which was until there's consequences, this is only going to escalate for the threat actors. What we've seen is as we crack down on the ransomware, whether it's better backups or the software to prevent it or decryption capabilities, we will see them pivot to other methods. And we've even seen threat actors move to other business models where they just exfiltrate or steal the data and then sell that data on an underground marketplace or do an extortion attempt against the victim. So as long as they can operate in, you know, with impunity and amnesty inside their country, whether that's Russia, Belarus or something similar, it's going to be difficult to stop this.
What has been the response from your clients? I would imagine this is an industry where it's not a good thing if you have repeat customers. But what has the response been in general? I know in reading an interview with you, there had been times where you had wanted to continue negotiating because you could thought that you could lower the price tag even more. And you had some clients say, no, we're willing to pay this. What has their reaction been in general?
Well, it depends on the size of the company. For the larger companies, the publicly traded companies, there's a lot of people involved, including lawyers, internal and external counsel, that are really driving those decisions. For almost everyone else, you're talking about an individual operator, maybe one or two IT professionals. It's a very emotional situation. So, a lot of people are potentially going to lose their jobs. People who have built businesses for 10 years might lose that business. And so part of this whole process is also being a counselor and helping them remain objective during this, unfortunate event.
This is so much about relationship building. And I'm wondering if part of you works on rehabilitating these hackers, right? And some of them just identify themselves as bad guys. Some say they have a mission and they're trying to do good work or what have you. Whatever their motivation, do you try to bring them onto the other side to work with you?
Well, with the individual operators, there's always an opportunity to get to know them better. And we have open dialogue sometimes with those folks. I have not hired any of them, but we do have sort of casual conversations about what they're doing and the impact of those things. I can't tell you whether that was effective or not. The rest of the ransomware operators are largely operating like a business. Many of the folks we're dealing with are employees of the larger entity, and it's very much a transactional thing. And so, you're not able to really penetrate at that level.
Well, Curtis Minter, it's been an educational time talking to you. I've learned a lot, and I would imagine that a lot of your clients are very happy with and satisfied with the work that you do in bringing their suffering to an end. That is a terrible note to get any time somebody opens their computer and see that they have been attacked and demanding ransomware. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's hard to know where to begin with our next guest, as his resume is so packed to the gills, it's almost tough to wrap your head around. Born in South Africa to Chinese parents, Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong studied medicine, then went to the United States, where he became a transplant surgeon and a researcher for NASA. If that wasn't enough, he then invented the cancer drug Abraxane, which put him on the path to becoming a billionaire. In 2018, he bought the Los Angeles Times, but he's still very much in the biotech world, working to develop a new form of COVID vaccine. Here he is discussing it all with Walter Isaacson.
Thank you, Biana and Dr. Soon-Shiong. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You've bought the Los Angeles Times, a storied newspaper. And as an old journalist, I have a question, which is, why would a surgeon with no media background who becomes an immigrant to the United States want to own a newspaper?
Well, I think it's all about my upbringing, right? So I was born in South Africa under apartheid. And the only thing that really kept me alive, inspired, educated, was the newspaper. So the Evening Post and the Herald, I would be there every day. I would be at the printing press as the paper came off. So it was in my blood, so to speak. And when the opportunity came for the LA Times, which I was very, very fearful of it being lost, and it speaks to power, it's important for democracy, it's important for free speech, and frankly, it's an educational tool. So to me, it was a great opportunity for me to take the storied newspaper and try and survive it.
When you were reading newspapers in South Africa during a period of apartheid, tell me the importance of that.
Well, you know, think about all the hardships and the atrocities some of the people would go through, and people who had the bravery and the courage to report that. Some of them were locked up. Some of them were put in house arrest. But that inspired us to, or inspired me at least, to be able to go to a single source of truth at least. And so again, I think it's important that a newspaper be a place where there could be some truth and integrity.
So you came over to Los Angeles with a medical training, you become a surgeon. How did your career take off in order to allow you to do things like buy newspapers?
By accident, honestly, because the pursuit of my the science and pursuit of the dream. So, you know, I came, as I said, from South Africa to Canada, and from Canada got recruited to UCLA. And Los Angeles is this cauldron of amazing innovation, Caltech, UCLA, USC, major schools. And as an assistant professor of surgery, I also got involved in NASA. So it's not very well known that I was also part of the Space Shuttle program. So my lens was from a surgeon that was doing pancreas transplant. And then the other part of my other lens is a surgeon doing what we call Whipples for pancreatic cancer. So I had a sort of unique view of the immune system of a human being. And from that forged everything I've done and everything I'm still doing with regard to trying to activate the immune system.
And so you became a biotech entrepreneur. How did you end up making so much money at that?
It wasn't an entrepreneur's perspective. It was really a scientific clinician. So I looked upon this as a clinician trying to establish a global practice of medicine. So my first vision was to actually create this nanoparticle of albumin for cancer. And again, I was going against dogma. Everybody, and still to this day, was giving high-dose chemotherapy to kill the tumor. And I recognize that, in fact, in so doing, we actually wipe out the immune system. So I wanted to create a nanoparticle, and it turns out that albumin is ubiquitous. All tumors, regardless of that, you lose weight. So I surmise that maybe the whole thing is the tumor is eating albumin. So why wouldn't we create a nanoparticle of albumin and allow the tumor to feed on that? And if you remember, those are the days when people were talking about starving the tumor. I said, let's feed the tumor, but feed it rat poison. So, So that was the pursuit, again, of a strategy that was against dogma, of a nanoparticle technology that didn't exist. And as you may know, President Clinton at that time had just created the Nanotechnology Institute within the federal government. So the pursuit of that, and when the hypothesis was correct and got approved for breast cancer, lung cancer, Abraxane did, Celgene wanted that molecule, and I was happy to sell it because I wasn't going to go into the next venture. And that's where the money came from.
And how are you trying to create a new form of COVID vaccine, which I know you're trying to bring into South Africa, which is facing a new strains of coronavirus?
Yeah, you know, from the outset, in when COVID hit in 2019, we recognized that this acting like cancer, this virus goes into your cells and uses the machinery to escape. It uses the cell itself. So blocking it alone with antibodies is not sufficient. You need to find a way to kill the infected cell. And the only way to kill that infected cell is with the T cell. So using our experience in cancer, by March 2020, we had the first GMP-produced vial that was going after the innards of the virus as opposed to just the surface of the virus. That innards is called the N protein and the surface is called the S protein. And so our approach was to generate T cells as well as antibodies. And that's where we are now.
And so that's fundamentally different from the messenger RNA vaccines that have been rolled out. Do you think that you're going to pass the clinical trials and have this used soon in South Africa and maybe the United States?
Well, we're already in trials in South Africa and we're already in trials in the United States. And the way to think about these different vaccines, there's what we call the DNA vaccine, which is these adenoviruses. Then there's an RNA vaccine, and then there's a single protein vaccine as broadly three big categories. It is my belief, actually, that the best opportunity for long-term protection is to have a combination of one of these two, an RNA vaccine plus a DNA vaccine or a protein vaccine plus a DNA vaccine, to allow different parts of the machinery of a human body to create different elements of the immune system. That is a complex systems approach that I've taken to cancer, and I'm trying to take that to COVID. So it's a marathon as opposed to a sprint. We've gone through the sprint. I recognize mutations will occur. They have occurred. The variants actually are non-responsive now to the antibodies, which is predictable. So we now at the second stage, which I call the second generation vaccines, which we are now going to bring through South Africa.
Tell me about growing up in South Africa from a family of Chinese immigrants.
Well, in a funny way, it was an upbringing that actually, as I said, forged everything I do. We couldn't vote. We had no right to property. We were poor shopkeepers. Yet the people with whom we were surrounded by, Indian, Black, Chinese, colored, so to speak, were in a sense happy people. And that's what I think is wonderful about the South African culture. They're in essence happy people. So while there was indeed hardships and inequities, we grew up as a community. And I think what forged me really is to fight for the underdog. And that's what we're sort of doing now. I was the first Chinese ever to be allowed to work in a white hospital. And the government said, if I did that, I would have taken 50% of the salary of my peers. My peers wanted to go on strike, and I said, no, you're not, because I want to get the best education as I can as an intern. I was there during the 1976 Soweto uprising, in which children were being shot in the back, so that I volunteered. I went to the TB clinics to help these kids. So I think all of that background forged me as a physician, as a physician scientist, to see how we can bring technology and create capacity in that country and then lead from that country for all of Africa. That's what's needed now.
How did that help inform your view or feelings about racism when you came to Los Angeles and became a newspaper owner?
You know, it gave me not only empathy, and, you know, when you see Black Lives Matter, people have this, well, verbiage, but unless you lived it, you really don't feel it or understand it. And racism is overt racism as it was in apartheid, but there's subconscious racism. There's unconscious racism, and there's conscious racism, and there's, so sadly, I began to realize, when I came to this country, and, you know, UCLA is in a very nice neighborhood, and I was looking for an apartment, and then we had the ability to find a house. One of our neighbors said, how did you get the money to buy a house here? USC professor said, maybe you should go back where you came. You know, it's, these are kinds of statements that I don't think is unusual. It's perverse in our country. And as I said, I had to stand up, especially with this Asian hate going on, that we need to recognize it. And as a newspaper, we can speak against it openly and recognize it and not be afraid to call it when we can. And ironically, I think South Africa is much more enlightened now because of what Mandela has done in terms of reconciliation. The country is enlightened. I see that enlightenment here yet in this country, ironically as it may seem.
How could we get towards that enlightenment?
By recognizing who we are. You know, the country is built on a fabric of slavery. It is built on a fabric of racism. There still is racism. And being very honest about it and recognizing it developing a level of compassion and humanity and dignity and respect. All these words are just words, but that's happening in South Africa now, largely because of what President Mandela did with regard to reconciliation and recognition. So maybe two or three generations, I am hopeful this next generation or two more generations are beginning to see this. Black Lives Matter and Asian hate is not a political statement. It's really hopefully a movement of recognition.
When you bought the LA Times, you wrote an essay in the paper saying that the paper had covered the city in a somewhat racist way in the past. Tell me what you meant by that. Give me some examples.
Well, if you look at the history, obviously it was before my time, way before when the Chandlers had the paper and everything else, and it is what it is. It's not to speak disparagingly about the evolution, but if you look at some of the terminologies that we were using, right? I mean, for example, President Ramaphosa rightly said, you know, the Soweto riots is not the Soweto riots, it was the uprising. And it's a very subtle terminology. Again, it's unconscious. So we needed our newsroom to understand when they say things like that, what do they really mean? And is this unconscious bias? Now, it was much more so before we took over, and we're trying to change that by really education of everybody within the organization. And I think the good news, I'm very pleased to say, it's really, really, I see real progress there.
And what are you doing to change the coverage of the newspaper so that it's done with a different racial perspective?
Well, I think one of the things is diversity of the newsroom itself, right? I mean, I think you can't write about a Caucasian writing about a Latino or somebody coming from African-American does not have the same empathy or perspective of somebody living in that community. So we're trying to create a diverse newsroom all across, all the way up to the editorial level. And as you now see with Kevin Merida coming on board and his insights, I'm really excited about that. So we need to change it all the way from the lowest level all the way up to the editorial level.
When you hired as your top editor recently, Kevin Merida, who is one of the foremost African-American journalists and editors in the United States, were you doing it consciously because you were seeking or trying or hoping to get a Black editor?
No, it wasn't. Again, that would have been, in a funny way, a racist thing to actually even look at, right? It was really to find somebody, one, who really understood the community, and because he was such a great journalist from Washington Post, and then he went into Disney and did ESPN and understood sports and understood the media and understood, and in addition, obviously, he had the knowledge and empathy of the racial issues. So all taken together, he was truly the perfect fit for where we need. I mean, the paper has to evolve into beyond a paper. It has to evolve into what I call a media platform. It's a challenge, but we're going to get there.
In order to buy the LA Times, there were some complex dealings with the Tribune Company that owned all the papers, including the LA Times at one point, that left you with a stake in the Tribune Company. And just recently, they sold to a hedge fund, Alden Capital. That's caused huge amounts of controversy. You didn't try to block that. Why not?
Because I'm just realistic and pragmatic. You know, I was hopeful that there would be, in fact, there was, as you may know, two other buyers. And pragmatically, I had my hands full with the Los Angeles Times and San Diego Tribune, which I thought was really important for me to survive. That paper's losing money, but now, thank God, we're doing a slow turnaround because of the millions of dollars we put into this infrastructure. And I knew just realistically, just doing, you know, so frankly, I wanted just the board to make its own decision. And as you know, what I did was just a non-vote. Said, you as a board need to go make this the right decision. And that's what they did.
But would you prefer that newspapers go into the hands of people like yourself who want to run them, and that we should try to avoid them going into the hands of hedge funds like this?
Of course. I mean, I think it's a public trust. I see the newspapers as a public trust. So, but, you know, Bezos has done his thing in Washington Post, done fantastically, obviously. I'm trying to do it. But there aren't many people that can afford that. It's a losing business. And we have to truly face the reason why that is so. And why that is so is because the platforms are usurping through fair use, and not fairly using fair use, to take a work of hard reporting and use it freely, and then take all the advertising dollars. And how can a business therefore survive in that kind of environment? So that's just the reality of life, and we have to figure out a way. So, you know, if Congress understands that newspapers is basically democracy, I have to find a way to help survive these newspapers. It can't be left to individuals like myself to take on the entire Chicago Tribune, Florida Sentinel, and all the Pennsylvania, as well as LA Times and San Diego Tribune. So this is really where it really needs a national attention.
Dr. Soon Chong, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
As we mentioned, President Joe Biden is set to arrive in the UK today. His press pool, however, had a bit of a delay with the flight. They were all set to go Tuesday night, but a swarm of cicadas had other ideas. Their invasion of the plane's exterior was so extensive that the airline had to call in another bug-free plane. That flight, well, it eventually took off this morning, more than 6.5 hours behind schedule. Delta Airlines says the cicadas caused an auxiliary power unit to fail. And even the commander-in-chief wasn't immune from a cicada attack. Take a listen.
Watch out for the cicadas. I just got one. It got me.
Right there on his neck. Well, finally, one woman's incredible journey across Europe. Ursula Martin just completed a mammoth 5,000-mile or 8,000-kilometer walk from Ukraine to Wales.
Yes! Yes!
Amazing. It took her 3 years, 8 pairs of boots, and even waiting out a 6-month lockdown. That's perseverance for you. But none of that deterred her. She took up rambling to raise awareness of ovarian cancer after being diagnosed in 2011. This latest adventure has raised more than $15,000 for charity, starting with a hitchhike to Kyiv, through the depths of Romania's winter, and across the Pyrenees to warmer days in Provence. We hope she's got her feet up for a well-earned rest. Bravo to you. Well, that is it for now. You could always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.